Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us tonight a friend. I've never met James Perloff, but I consider him a friend. I've talked to him dozens of times. And James had written a book many years ago called Shadows of Power. It was the story of America's invisible government, the Council on Foreign Relations, that really controls the leadership of both political parties. CIA director always comes from there, the head of the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, Secretary of State, so many of our presidents or vice presidents have come from this small organization. They control, or their members control, literally all of the media, the right, the left wing. A fascinating book, and we've always really appreciated it. We still carry the book to this day called Shadows of Power. But then James turned his attention to other things. He wrote a wonderful book, or Tornado in a Junkyard, which goes into the situation as far as evolution and creation is concerned, and the whole idea that Darwinians would have us believe that just with enough time and chance that we could create humanity, and the old idea that if a tornado hit a junkyard enough times and enough pieces were there, why, we could end up with a 747. Anybody who believes that's got to be have an awful lot of faith. It takes a lot more faith to believe that than it does to believe that God created the heaven and the earth. And then James had written an essay on Pearl Harbor. We had done on a number of times, going into the background of what happened at Pearl Harbor. And we've had him on with a music CD that he's put together, and he may want to mention that this evening. We've had him on this program in the past, playing some of the music from it. But tonight we were going to talk about a short book he's written dealing with Darwin, because the problem we have is that most people will not read a long book today. Now, some people will, but you want something that you can give to somebody, perhaps in two or three hours, they can understand the subject, an easy book to read, and yet one that's hard-hitting. And so what's the title of this new book? Is it Darwin's Dilemma?
No, it's called The Case Against Darwin.
The Case Against Darwin, all right. And it's a great book. It's short, concise, and to the point. And why did you write this, James?
Well, as you mentioned, Stan, I've written a book called Tornado in a Junkyard, which deals with the creation-evolution debate in depth. But over a year ago, I received a call from someone in Ohio where there was a battle to get criticism of evolution introduced into public schools, and that actually was successfully done with the Ohio State School Board. But this individual was asking me for copies of Tornado in a Junkyard to give to state legislators and school board members, and I said to him, you know, I'd be happy to send you these 40 books he'd asked for, but I said, you know, I think that a state legislator is too busy to read a 300-page book, you know. And I was thinking about it. I said, you know, I really need to boil this down. It was already a user-friendly book, but I said, I really need to boil down this to a very short book that somebody can read in one sitting. And that's what The Case Against Darwin is. It's 83 pages long, large print, and the average person can read it in 1 to 2 hours. And I really felt there's a need for something like that, especially as you were saying, Stan, in this day and age, a lot of people don't have the time or maybe even the inclination to read a longer book.
Well, I agree with you, and you did a great job on it. So why don't you go ahead and sort of outline what is the case against Darwin? What you know, after all, the science has proven, at least we're told, science has proven evolution. The question is science being misused to tell a lie? So why don't you pick up some of the things that you cover so well?
Okay. Well, what I do in this book, Stan, I divide it into three parts. The first part is just talking about the relevance of the topic, because a lot of people think, hey, you know, this is just a science subject, boring, ho-hum, you know, what's it got to do with my life? And we talk in that first chapter about how Darwinism replaced really the Bible as an explanation for our origins, and when it did that, it made God an irrelevancy in our culture. You know, for many people say, well, if it's been proven scientifically that, you know, God didn't create life, but we all evolved from apes, and, you know, life started from a single cell by chance processes because the right amino acids came together in the ancient ocean, ta-da, ta-da. A lot of people just decided that God was not relevant, and we've really seen so much moral decline in our culture because people, once they stop believing in God, they stop believing in the moral absolutes that we associate with God, like the Ten Commandments and the Golden Rule. The second part of the book, of the three parts of the book, is the growing scientific case against Darwinism. We look at six specific areas of evidence that have risen in recent years that show Darwin's theory of evolution is wrong. And the final chapter of the book, we look at some of the evidences used to support Darwinism that have been proven either to be false or fraudulent, or at least to best rest on shaky assumptions. But for the public, many of them still assume that many of those so-called proofs, like Haeckel's pictures of embryos, are true. So that's our last chapter. We point out that a lot of the evidences for Darwinism have, in fact, been brought into discredit in recent years.
Well, let's just get started at the very beginning and start going through this, because it's important that people can discuss this and discuss it intelligently. So what are these various points that have arisen that would suggest that Darwin was really way, way off, and there is new scientific evidence coming up all the time? I mean, certainly the genetic codes that have been worked out, the ability to follow people, you know, back to a common origin. And it appears that, you know, all of the genetic work suggests we all did originate from one man. And there are no intermediate stages out there. They've never found an intermediate stage. I remember when I was going to school, we were told the Piltdown man. Oh, it was the Piltdown man. He was the missing link. And it was a lie. It was a scientific fraud, as have been so many of the intermediate phases, the Java man and the Peking man and Lucy. They're all frauds, but if they don't have a missing link, then maybe God may have created the heaven and the earth. And to the paleontologist, it doesn't matter if all the evidence shows that Darwin was wrong. They cannot accept the fact that there's a God. Isn't that really one of the major factors?
Well, I think that's the driving force behind evolution. Charles Darwin himself, just to quote Charles Darwin in 1873, said this. Now, he mentioned someone named Lyell. That was an evolutionary geologist, Charles Lyell. Darwin said this. He said, quote, "Lyell is most firmly convinced that he's shaken the faith in the deluge," meaning the biblical flood, "far more efficiently by never having said a word against the Bible than if he'd acted otherwise. I've read lately Morley's Life of Voltaire, and he insists strongly that direct attacks on Christianity, even when written with a wonderful force and vigor of Voltaire, produce little permanent effect. Real good seems only to follow the slow and silent side attacks," unquote, Charles Darwin. And so there, Stan, we have Charles Darwin himself acknowledging his own science as a slow and silent side attack on Christianity. And I think that's why Darwinism persists over the years. You know, you're talking about the Piltdown man, and when you go back to the time of the Scopes trial, which was called the trial of the century, you know, with the creation-evolution debate, in effect, at the time of the Scopes trial, Clarence Darrow, the atheistic lawyer, brought a slew of evolutionists to provide evidence in favor of evolution. And, you know, the three main evidences that they presented included the Piltdown man, embryonic recapitulation, which is now known to be fraudulent, and vestigial organs, which they were naming 180 vestigial organs of the body, so-called useless structures of the human body, which we now know are functional. Well, it's interesting that all of those have been discredited since, but the evolutionists have come up with a number of new proofs. Now, most sciences, if the theory is proven to be wrong, or if the evidence that supports it has been falsified, they'll drop the theory. Not the case with evolution, however, because at its root, as Darwin said, it's a slow and silent attack on God.
And I think it's so vitally important that people understand what it's really all about. It's not about an effort to find the truth about the ancestors of various animals. It's all about discrediting Christianity. Christianity has been under attack for a long period of time, but Never before have they had the amount of money and, of course, the people placed in high positions in scientific institutions. And some of these people, I'm sure, are misled. Some of these people, honestly, mm-hmm. believe they're right. But some of the people know they're wrong, and yet, of course, this is how they're going to destroy Christianity. So let's you actually, in your book, and we carry it, called Tornado in the Junkyard, and we think it's a great book, and you go into great detail in the Scopes trial, and what was really said there, and actually why... The fellow on our side did a pretty good job, didn't he? William Jennings Bryan did a pretty good job?
Well, that's correct. You know, I have a chapter in there on the Scopes trial, and, you know, there's a movie called Inherit the Wind, a very famous movie and play, which many people take to be an accurate depiction of what happened in Dayton, Tennessee in 1925. But what I do in my book, Tornado in the Junkyard, is I take the court transcript and compare it to the movie transcript so we can see just how badly Hollywood distorted that the situation. Give you a couple of examples. Of course, the Scopes trial was the so-called monkey trial. The Tennessee state legislature had passed something called the Butler Act, which outlawed the teaching that man had evolved from a lower life form. It did not outlaw other forms of evolutionary teaching. In any event, the trial got a lot of attention because, as you were mentioning, supporting the prosecution was William Jennings Bryan, who had been the presidential candidate of the Democratic Party. And on the other side of the aisle, supporting John Scopes and favoring evolution was the atheist attorney, Clarence Darrow, who was the most famous criminal attorney of his day. That, plus the fact that it's talking about the essential question of whether we're here by chance or by the creation of God, really gave this trial enormous publicity. Well, if you look at the movie, the way the movie opens up, you've got these Christian fundamentalists marching to the local high school where John Scopes is forthrightly teaching evolution, and they arrest him, they throw him in jail. He's a persecuted martyr, right?
He didn't even teach evolution,
did he? Even teach evolution. Let me quote John Scopes himself in his autobiography, Center of the Storm. He said, quote, "Darrow had been afraid for me to go on the stand. Darrow realized I was not a science teacher. He was afraid that if I were put on the stand, I would be asked if I actually taught biology. If the boys got the review of evolution from me, I was unaware of it. I didn't remember teaching it," unquote. John Scopes. Well, so he never even taught evolution, and he certainly never went to jail, because the Butler Act only provided for a fine for teaching evolution. That was not a jailable offense, and Scopes never had to pay that fine. In fact, there was the whole thing was amicably arranged. The ACLU was simply looking for someone who'd step forward and volunteer to say he taught evolution, to act as a test challenge to the law. But John Scopes never taught it, and he was certainly no martyr.
You know, the tragedy is that there's such corruption in our courts. I mean, you look at the cases of Roe versus Wade, and I've forgotten whether it was Roe or Doe, but this woman said she was deprived of an abortion, and she didn't even necessarily want an abortion, but the whole thing was rigged. And now, of course, all these years later, why she's going back and trying to say, "I was told a lie. I was told a lie." But are they going after the attorneys that told her to lie? No. Nor did they go after the attorneys who staged the Scopes trial. These are showcases. They use our courts to advance a political agenda, but it's really an anti-Christian agenda, whether it be abortion, whether it be evolution. They're all part and parcel of the same ball of wax.
Right. It's interesting you mentioned the Roe versus Wade, the woman, how she's completely turned around on that. You know, William J. Murray was the little boy, the son of the atheist Madeline Murray O'Hara, who was he was the focus of the court case that got prayer tossed out of our schools. And now he's become a born-again Christian. He's written a book called My Life Without God, and he has a ministry now in Washington, D.C.
Right.
It's amazing the turnaround that happened. Of course, Stan, I myself was an atheist and someone who endorsed the theory of evolution years ago, and it was somebody who ridiculed Christians, but God can really work changes in people's hearts.
He certainly can, but so many people are losing their faith in Christianity because of the phony and illegitimate and, frankly, dishonest science surrounding evolution. So let's get on to some of the other issues there. As you list them in this very straightforward but very simple little book, yet with so much valuable information in it.
Well, let's talk about the evidence against evolution. Let's start looking at some of the evidences. Now, Darwin's theory says that fish evolved into human beings over a long period of time. So a question we have to ask is, how did fish get the genetic code to become human beings? Because they've got a very different gene pool than we do. Now, Darwin didn't know about genetics, you know, it was not a science in his day, and so he thought that animals just had this unlimited capacity to adapt to their environment. But with the discovery of genetics, evolutionists suddenly realized that no animal could make any adaptation unless they first had the genes for that adaptation. So what was the solution they came up with? Well, it was eventually discovered that genes sometimes mutate. You know, genes mutate once in a while. It's usually a rare event, but it involves a sudden change in genetic information. So the modern theory of evolution says, well, look, the fish mutated the right genes to become human beings over millions of years. They get a mutation, which gives them a little part of an arm or a leg or some other significant advantage, and spread through the whole species of fish. And step by step, they mutated the right genes to become human beings. Well, that no longer holds up. Dr. Lee Spetner of Johns Hopkins University spent years studying mutations on a molecular level, and he's written a new book. It's called Not by Chance: Shattering the Modern Theory of Evolution. And let me just quote Dr. Spetner, quote, "In all the reading I've done in life sciences literature, I've never found a mutation that added information. All point mutations studied on a molecular level turn out to reduce genetic information and not increase it," unquote, Dr. Spetner. Now, this readily agrees, Stan, with what we can observe. What do mutations cause in human beings? Sickle cell anemia, cystic fibrosis, Down syndrome, and about 4,000 other genetic diseases. God created the genetic code to perfectly run an organism, and a mutation is simply a copying error. It loses information, but never does it create new information. Never does it create a new organ, hormone, or other useful structure.
And so the genetic code, the study in genetics, really is sort of embarrassing for the evolutionists, isn't it?
Right. Now, of course, they will say that there are beneficial mutations, and that's true. Once in a while, you can get a mutation that will lose information and still be beneficial. For example, in antibiotic resistance for bacteria, they point this as an example of evolution. Well, it's true that a mutation can sometimes help a bacterium, a germ, to fight off one of these drug-killing one of these germ-killing drugs called antibiotics. But this is not what the evolutionist pictures is, that these mutations are making these bacteria bigger and better and stronger to fight off these drugs, you know, making them better adapted. Dr. Spetner points out this is based on a complete misunderstanding of antibiotic resistance. What happens is you have, for example, the antibiotic streptomycin, which can destroy a bacterium by attaching to part of the bacterial cell called ribosomes. Well, sometimes mutation will cause a deformity in ribosomes, and because of that deformity, the antibiotic cannot attach, but it's still not evolution, it's still a deformity. You know, if you cut off your arms, that might prevent you from getting drafted into the army and might, help you survive in wartime, but you still wouldn't call it evolution. Well, that's all these mutations are. They're loss of genetic information, and once in a while, you can find a benefit to them, but they certainly aren't creating anything higher or more complex.
All right, so that the genetic code is one of the big problems with the Darwinians have. What about some of the others that you can think of?
Well, if you open up a child's biology textbook today, it'll say that life began in the ancient ocean about 3 billion years ago when the right chemicals came together to form the first cell, and all life came from that first cell. Well, you know, Charles Darwin got this idea going. He talked in The Origin of Species about how life began in a warm little pond, and he described the right chemicals that he thought would form this little cell. Well, fine, in Darwin's day, cells were thought to be rather simple, but we now know that the information content of even a so-called simple bacterial cell would fill 100 million pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Stan, you're just not going to get that kind of information by chance. No way. And there's no way a cell could have formed step by step by survival of the fittest, because right now we're talking about the dead chemicals that came before the first cell.
So
we need a genetic code, thousands of proteins, hundreds of amino acids in chains which form those proteins. You need translation devices with genetic code just to get that first cell going. And just think about it. Even if that first little cell did form in the ocean, before it died, it must have completely perfected the whole system of cellular reproduction, or there never would have been another cell. These are the kind of objections to the theory of evolution that are not being raised in a public school classroom that should be discussed.
And the thing is, science really is based upon observation and the ability to duplicate your findings. There's nobody that saw this. This is all an idea, a concept, an effort to come up with an explanation, any explanation. Doesn't matter how ridiculous the explanation is, any explanation will do other than God created the heaven and the earth. And God created living matter. And that's the one thing they can't accept. So they'll come up with things that are so ridiculous that if people were objective, they would laugh them right out of the classrooms. But, of course, when you stand there and said, science has proven as if, thus says the Lord, why an awful lot of people believe. We're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest, James Perloff, talking about the case against Darwin. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, James Perloff, and we're talking about the case against Darwin, and we're just going through the various specific issues that show this whole thing is a lie. So pick it up from there, James.
Okay. We talked a little about genetic code and how it could not have developed through mutations from fish to man. We talked a little about how a cell is too complex to have come about by chance from the knowledge we now have of cells. And, of course, my books will go into a lot more depth we're covering tonight. Another area of evidence comes from biochemistry, and Dr. Michael Behe, who's a biochemist down at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania, has written a book called Darwin's Black Box, The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution. And, Stan, he talks in there with a concept you know of. It's called irreducible complexity. He points out that in the human body, there are certain systems that are so complex that it's impossible for them to evolve. You take away one component, and the whole system falls apart. It can't function, so it's impossible for it to have evolved step by step, and he calls that irreducible complexity. Now, what I just said sounds very abstract, so let's take a practical example given by Dr. Behe, would be the blood clotting system. Well, when we get a cut, the bleeding is normally stopped by a blood clot, and to our naked eye, that blood clot might look simple, but to a biochemist like Dr. Behe, that's a very complex creation, that blood clot involves well over a dozen steps to make one. Now, a person with the disease hemophilia is missing just one of those clotting factors, and he's at high risk for bleeding. If you're missing two or three clotting factors, forget it. You'll have no chance for survival. You'll bleed to death. So the question Dr. Behe asks is this. How then could blood clotting have evolved? The Darwinian model would say it evolved step by step over eons. Well, you know what? If you have one or two or three clotting factors, won't do any good. Seven or eight or nine won't do you any good. You're going to bleed to death. And if creatures bled to death, they never could have passed on the incremental stages of the next generation. There's no way that blood clotting could have evolved. He does the same thing, Stan, with the immune system. If the immune system had evolved step by step over eons, creatures would have been wiped out by disease before it ever got perfected. The whole system is interdependent between the antibodies and the white blood cells and so forth. That's irreducible complexity. That's a third area of evidence showing Darwin was wrong, thanks to Dr. Michael Behe.
All right, so irreducible complexity is number three. What else do you have?
Well, you were talking about the missing links before, and that takes us into a whole other arena. You know, Darwin's theory, okay, says that life started as a single cell, which became marine invertebrates, which are simply creatures in the ocean without a backbone, like a jellyfish, which evolved into fish, which evolved into amphibians, which would be the first land creatures. Amphibians are creatures that go on land or sea, like a frog. The amphibians evolved into reptiles, reptiles into mammals, and mammals into man. That's Darwin's theory in a nutshell. Now, a missing link, or a link, would be an intermediate form, a creature that is halfway between a reptile and an amphibian, or a creature that's halfway between a marine invertebrate and a fish. Now, there's three areas, three places where you can look to find evidence for these links to see if Darwin's theory is true or not. And the first, Dan, is in the living world around us. Now, the science that classifies the living world is called taxonomy. That's where we you find the word species and genus and so forth. And that system was pioneered by Carolus Linnaeus, a biologist and a biblical creationist. And he was dead against the theory of evolution, Stan, because when he looked at the living world around us, he saw what? He saw what we see. What do we see today? We see that the living world is divided into, we have bacteria, we've got invertebrates, we've got fish, reptiles, amphibians, mammals, nothing in between them. If Darwin's theory is true, it seems that not a single one of those intermediate creatures survived to this day. Even though we have billions of these various animals in the world today, the mammals and reptiles and amphibians and so forth, there's not a single creature which is intermediate between them. That's strike one against Darwin in the area of intermediates and transitional forms.
Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, our guest this evening is James Perloff, and we're talking about the proofs against Darwin, and of course we started out with the genetic code, and then we went to the origin of life. We went into biochemistry and the fact that There are just so many systems within the body, described in a book called Darwin's Black Box, the complexity of the immune system, the complexity of blood clotting, that you have an irreducible complexity. There's just no way to explain these complex concepts or procedures or physiological reactions happening simply by accident or evolving, because they're so complicated. Any one step, missing, why the whole system falls apart. And now James has been talking about the various missing links. So why don't you pick up that story? Where is the missing link between man and reptile, or man and in fact, we don't even really have any missing links between a man and apes, do we?
Well, the National Geographic would say that we do, but you were astutely pointing out earlier about the Piltdown Man, Stan. At the time that the Piltdown Man was introduced to the public, you know, was endorsed by many leading scientists such as Sir Arthur Keith, the noted anatomist, and Arthur Smith Woodward, the geologist at the British Museum. And the headline in the New York Times at that time was "Darwin Theory Proved True."
And that went on for 50 years that they believed this lie. I mean, how can you believe scientists who could be so easily taken in? Where were all the rest of the scientists checking out the validity of this phony claim? And it was a charade. It was an intentional effort to convince the public that this was a missing link, and it just wasn't so.
Right. The Piltdown Man was claimed to be a genuine ape man 500,000 years old. Well, you know, the jawbone was simply a very recent orangutan jaw, which somebody had filed the teeth on to make it the more human, shorter and more human-looking, and they stained it to look old. But it succeeded in fooling all those guys at the British Museum. And that's the kind of thing still goes on, Stan. You know, the 1999 November National Geographic had a 10-page color spread on something called the Archaeoraptor, which was said to be the true missing link, or a true missing link, between dinosaurs and birds. Also just a fake. A Chinese farmer had simply taken a tail from a small dinosaur fossil and glued it to a bird fossil, and it succeeded in fooling the folks at National Geographic. These are examples of how, when you're looking for something, you can find it. Let's remember that in a fossil, 99% of an animal's biology is in its soft anatomy, which you cannot access in a fossil, and that's why these fossils get invested with a lot of imagination.
Okay, so the tragedy is that science is not looking to find out if it's a fraud, because they want to find the missing link. Because if they can find the missing link, then they think that they somehow can prove that there is no God. And that's what it's all about. And until we understand that, why, we will continue to be confused. So what about some of the other things?
Well, we talked about the fact that in the world of taxonomy, which is the science that classifies the living world around us, we don't see any missing links between, or any living intermediate forms between the marine invertebrates and the fish and the amphibians and the reptiles and mammals. And we also see this lack of evidence in the fossil record. Just to pick up on that a little bit more, we're talking about human fossils, so-called human ancestors. But in the whole arena of Darwin's theory, we find that the missing links are still missing. For example, Darwin's theory says that bacteria evolved into the marine invertebrates, the first jellyfish and so forth. Well, if you look down at the low geologic layer called Cambrian Rock, it has most of the oldest known fossils of a marine invertebrate. You can find billions of marine invertebrate fossils down there, fossils of jellyfish and snails and clams and worms and so forth. But how many fossils are there showing how they evolved? They're showing that they came from a common ancestor. And the answer is none. The late Stephen Jay Gould of Harvard, a noted evolutionist, said, quote, "Our more extensive labor has still failed to identify any creature that might serve as a plausible immediate ancestor for the Cambrian faunas," unquote. Faunas meaning animals. Well, Stan, to go to the next level, invertebrates supposedly evolved as the first fish. You can find billions of invertebrate fossils, billions of fish fossils, but how many intermediate forms do you find? And the answer is none. Gerald T. Todd, writing an American zoologist, wrote this, quote, "All subdivisions of the bony fishes first appear in the fossil record at approximately the same time. Why is there no trace of earlier intermediate forms?" Unquote. So, you know, why do we have this complete lack of intermediates in both the living world and the fossil world? Well, one way to look at it is, well, although the living intermediates all became extinct, the fossils all got eroded away, but a much more sensible explanation is to simply say, hey, they never existed. Animals were created complete, just as the Bible says. That's why they appear suddenly and complete in the fossil record.
Well, you know, I look back on my days in high school and college and indoctrinated in these concepts of evolution, and you accept this. And now, one of the hardest things for me when I first became a Christian was to begin to challenge everything I'd learned in college. And what a shocking experience it was to realize that I hadn't been educated in college, and I'd had all these honors and keys, and I'd been indoctrinated in college with a lie. We'll be back in just a moment or two with James Perloff. Welcome your calls here at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when, well, I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there listening to our programs will feel a kinship with our message and realize that we do what we do because we're trying to educate people. Now, why is this issue important? Why? Because there's a spiritual battle going on today. There's a conspiracy against God. That's what it's all about. And the concept of pushing evolution is an important part of that to destroy the faith of our young people. And many of them will never return to the faith of their fathers because they've been lied to in school so convincingly, and they're not going to take the time to check out the facts. After all, they learned it in college. It must be true. Well, the truth is that we have people working in our colleges who may or may not believe it, but there's one thing that seems to join so many of them together, and that is the hatred of Christianity. There is a conspiracy against God. There has always been one, and it carries over not only into this subject, but into every aspect of our society today. That's really what the current effort to bring about the one world government is all about, preparing the way for the Antichrist. And believe me, we're moving rapidly towards a one world government. And whether this is going to come about after the coming war, and I believe there is going to be a war, we are doing everything we can to justify other countries attacking America. We've established preemptive wars perfectly all right. So if it's all right for us to attack another country and kill the people there in the name of liberating them, how could we possibly object if somebody were to launch a preemptive strike on America to liberate our people? At least that's what their justification would be. And you say it could never happen. America's the mightiest nation in the world. Well, America may have an awful lot of technology, but the trouble is that the spirit of the morality that once made America the envy of the world has ceased to exist. We are no longer a moral nation basing our beliefs upon God. We are basing our beliefs upon power, and power corrupts absolutely everyone. Well, if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and join us in this epic struggle to educate the American people, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. I would love to hear from you. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, the latest one deals with the origins of modern-day anti-Semitism, why anti-Semitism is being used as a smokescreen to cover something else. Why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Pull down our programs, pull down our newsletters. Help us get the word out across America while we can. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and we have our guest, a special guest this evening is James Perloff. Now, we do carry his book, The Tornado in the Junkyard, but James, how can people get hold of you if they want to get a copy of your book, The Case Against Darwin?
Well, actually, Radio Liberty has ordered some of those lately, so they can get it from Radio Liberty.
Right.
Also, The Case Against Darwin. But if they visit my website, refugebooks.com, that's refugebooks.com, they can send me an email through the website, and they can also get more information about the books that I've written.
All right.
They can order these books from many places through their local bookstore as well.
That's refugebooks.com, and I guess we're going to be carrying the Case Against Darwin. Let's go to Steve, calling from Richland, Washington. Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
Good evening, Dr. Stan. Doing real good. Don't get your show much often anymore because of my hours. And I was coming home from school early tonight and heard one of my favorite authors on the show with you.
Well, good to have you with us.
And I just thought I'd pop in and say hi and tell... Perloff that his book is by far the most loaned out of any book in my library. And even before I was a believer, I'd sit at a bar till 2 in the morning telling somebody they were an idiot for believing in evolution. But I thought one of my favorite quotes from his book is Thomas Huxley's his famous line, if you give a monkey a typewriter and enough time that he could reproduce Shakespeare, and the numbers that Mr. Perloff goes through to actually prove that that's a ridiculous thought.
And, of course, I think how much even more difficult it would be to build a 747, but I don't think the 747 is any more complex than the human body.
Probably far less complex.
In fact, if you were to have a wristwatch and you were to tell somebody that it evolved from just sort of happened, everybody would think you were crazy. But if you tell people that human beings evolved from lower forms of life, they will accept this without any serious question because of the phony baloney of so much science that's out there. That is not science at all. It's prostitution of science. And I'm really ashamed of the people who go along with this when they know it's a lie. Anything else you want to say, Steve?
No, I just wanted to say thanks, Mr. Perloff, and hi to you.
Well, it's good to hear from you. Fine. Give my best to your wife.
Will do.
And the new one, doing all right?
Yeah, we'll show them off to you here pretty soon.
All right,
we'll
look
great.
Good. Bye-bye, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay, fine. Steve used to come here and actually be one of our producers many years ago before he moved
cool.
up there to Washington. So anyway, if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question, a comment, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But this subject is so important that there are no missing links. Every time they come up with one, why, it's always disproven. You would think they'd eventually get sort of tired of trying this same old line over and over again, wouldn't you? But they never seem to.
No, and just to pick up on that, we're talking a little bit earlier to the audience about the various places where you can look for missing links, and one was in the world of the living world around us, taxonomy, we don't find it, and one was in the fossil record. Well, you know, there's another area, Stan, and that's in the microscopic world of the cell itself. And Dr. Michael Denton is an Australian molecular biologist. He's written a book called Evolution of Theory in Crisis. He went looking for transitional forms or missing links on a molecular level. That is to say, he would look at the molecular structures in fish and amphibians and reptiles and mammals to see if there's any evidence for that sequence. When he did that, you know, what he found out, he found that on a molecular level, the amphibians are just as distant from fish as we are. In other words, they are not the close cousins of fish. And let me just quote Dr. Denton, what he wrote in his book, quote, "Instead of revealing a multitude of transitional forms through which the evolution of a cell might have occurred, molecular biology has served only to emphasize the gap. No living system could be thought of as being ancestral with respect to any other system, nor is there the slightest hint of an evolutionary sequence among all the incredibly diverse cells on Earth." Unquote. Dr. Michael Denton.
All right, well, let's go to Terry, who's calling in from Spokane. Hi, Terry. Question or comment?
Hi, Dr. Stan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Thank you for having such a fine guest on tonight. I have a question. I've heard that Darwin had a real problem with the human eye. When he looked at it, he wasn't sure what to think about that, and it was a real problem for him in his theory. Maybe your guest could elaborate a little bit on that.
Do you want to discuss that? Terry was saying that he'd heard that Darwin had a little problem explaining the human eye, because of its complexity.
Well, let me just quote Darwin from The Origin of Species. He said that to suppose that the eye, with all its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus at different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, and with the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration, could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree, unquote. Now, Darwin did go on to say that he felt that it could have been done, that he thought, if you just had a sequence of more and more complex eyes, that it could have happened. But when you really think about it, this is another area that fits into the area of irreducible complexity, because there are so many parts that have to be working for the vision to exist. You need the lens, you need the retina, you need the optic nerve. What came first? Was it the optic nerve? Was it the lens? All those factors have to be there for vision to exist. Now, Richard Dawkins, in support of the evolutionary idea, said that, if you start out with a primitive light-sensitive spot, it could evolve from that. Well, Dr. Behe, in his book, Darwin's Black Box, points out that a so-called light synthesis spot is anything but primitive. You have an incredibly complex biochemistry on the line in it for that to happen. And so you not only need the growth structures of the eye, you need very complex biochemical systems which underlie vision, which he outlines in his book.
Okay. Anything else, Terry?
Yes. Well, while I'm thinking about it, did he have any other kind of problems with anything in the human body, or the creation of the human body that kind of threw him off, or did he try to explain that away like he did the eye?
Darwin really had no real difficulty in explaining any, natural selection was so plastic that all an animal would have to do is it would keep adapting and it could eventually develop. If you believe that you could go from a cell, a single cell, to a human being, then basically you believe that any adaptation is possible. And as evolutionists today believe that there's no limit to how much you can adapt and develop through adaptation and mutation. But that all is facing very serious scientific obstacles today.
Okay. Anything else, Terry?
Just one more thing while I'm thinking about it. Could you tell me a little bit more about what I've heard of from, I believe it's Professor Gould at Harvard, and his theory of called punctuated equilibrium?
Sure.
I don't understand that very much.
Sure. Well, that is a theory, punctuated equilibrium. Boy, that sounds intellectual, doesn't it? Developed by Stephen Jay Gould and another evolutionist named Niles Eldridge back in the 70s. And they were acutely aware of the fact that it was a great lack of transitional forms in the fossil record that would validate Darwin's theory. So they came up with this alternative theory, and what they said was that a species persists for a long time unchanged, and this is what they call equilibrium. And they said after this long period of going through no change, a small a portion of the species would break away from the main species, just a few animals, and they would very rapidly evolve and become superior, and then they would return to the environmental niche of that big species and would take it over because they're so superior. Now, since only a few animals were involved with the evolution process, that's why you don't find that transitional forms, because the main body of animals were not involved with that. There were just a few animals off to the side, in other words. Now, the punctuation, when the species suddenly changes, when it gets overtaken by this new highly evolved species from these few animals, that's when these species is being punctuated by that, and then it enters a new stage of equilibrium. So it's equilibrium not being changed and then punctuated, changed by these animals off to the side, the small subdivision, which there were so few of them that they didn't leave any transitional fossils behind. Now that's a theory which they developed to try and explain the lack of transitional fossil forms, but they didn't really have any observational evidence to support that idea that actually happens in nature. And the other thing that might just be mentioned about that is that it does not address the various other difficulties of the theory of evolution, such as the fact that mutations always lose information. They don't create higher genetic information.
Okay, thanks very much, Terry. Let's go over to Michael calling from Spokane as well. Hi, Michael. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show. I'd just like to say that I'm a degree geologist, but I'm a believer. I believe in Jesus Christ. I believe the Bible is true and honest, an accurate record of creation as it really is. And I became a believer as a result of my geologic education. I began to realize, as I was in my studies, about my third or fourth year in geology, that I was being told lies. I was being taught something that couldn't be sustained or supported by the truth. And I began to realize that a number of the geologic assemblages that are found around the world are flood deposits, and they are actually, in fact, proof of a worldwide flood, and the geologists are holding back this obvious truth because they don't want to reveal the truth. And if you're a seeker after the truth, if you're truly a scientist, you're looking for the truth.
No, because
and Jesus Christ said, everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. And so I believe that anybody who's truly and honestly looking for the truth, they'll encounter Jesus Christ as the true and living Lord.
I think very well said. And I've often said that how are you going to get oil unless, of course, there was something that came and trapped all these little critters underneath the level of sand? And how are you going to get coal unless there was something laid down a great deal of sediment and earth on top of all this this vegetable matter that the compression produced coal? How would you respond to what Michael was saying there, James?
I'd rejoice in what he said, and would ask him to even share more on his insights. I'll just quickly say on this end that that's absolutely right. That if you look at the geologic column, well, how do you explain all those fossils? Because you know, to fossilize a creature, and you have these wonderfully complete fossilized creatures, including soft-bodied creatures. How did they to get fossilized? They had to be buried very quickly, otherwise they would have decayed or been eaten by other animals. And you have billions of these fossils in the earth, but very few being created today. The worldwide flood, which would have churned up billions of tons of sediment, would explain the geologic column, would explain why you have all those fossils. And of course, there are other phenomena which I'm sure that Michael is familiar with, like what we call polystrate fossils, which you find like in coral layers. You can find trees extending up through what some geologists, uniformitarian geologists, would call millions of years of geologic time.
And they withhold that.
Yeah.
They withhold evidence like that, where actually a tree, exactly what you've explained, and I believe they've even found, you know, bones protruding through what are according to the geologic record as they maintain it, that would totally debunk. You know, the whole geologic column, and they would have to reorganize all this thinking. And so, in order to sustain what is a comfortable living for themselves, what is a comfortable, juggling act that they have involved, and it's just an esoteric knowledge base, and they do a lot and a great deal to maintain it.
I think we're all said. Well, thank you so much, Michael.
You bet. God bless you.
God bless you, too. Bye-bye. And it's very hard when you're going to college to challenge your professor and say, I don't think you're telling the truth. Obviously, Michael was very smart enough to realize that all these things where they talk about the billions and billions of years and, eons and eons to create the coal and the oil, there's something wrong with the story. Well, anyway, we're running a little out of time. Is there anything else trouble Darwin's have before we can? I want to get to those pictures by Haeckel, because
right.
Those are so important, because I remember seeing those pictures when I went to college and looked at that, and gee, you saw the similarity between the embryo of the pig and the embryo of the human, and I don't know what the other embryos were, but they just all look exactly the same, which is why they have this phrase, phylology recapitulates ontogeny. Phylology recapitulates ontogeny, suggesting that we all go through the same levels of development from the lowest form of life to the higher form of life. We just evolve a little bit better. The only trouble is, it was all a lie, wasn't it?
Yes. Those pictures were designed by the Darwinist Ernst Haeckel, and here's how he explained them. I'll quote him. He said this, quote, when we see that at a certain stage the embryos of man and ape, dog and rabbit, pig and sheep, the recognizable as higher vertebrates, cannot be distinguished from each other, the fact can only be elucidated by assuming a common parentage, unquote. In other words, Haeckel's saying, look, you can't tell a human embryo from a dog embryo or a rabbit embryo at an early stage, and so you know that we all had a common ancestor. Well, that was all exposed as a fraud back in the year 1915, 50 years before I was shown those pictures in the public school. The book was called Haeckel's Frauds and Forgeries by J. Asmus and Ernest Hull. And they quoted 19 leading scientists of the day that these were fraudulent. Just for one example, Ed the Anatomist F. Keibel of Freiburg University said, quote, it clearly appears that Haeckel has in many cases freely invented embryos or reproduced the illustrations given by others in a substantially changed form, unquote. Stan, as we've mentioned before, in our interviews together, Dr. Michael Richardson is an embryologist at St. George's Medical School in London. He assembled a scientific team to investigate this matter. They photographed the growing embryos of 39 different species. Let me just quote what Dr. Richardson said in a 1997 interview with London's The Times, quote, referring to Haeckel's pictures, quote, this is one of the worst cases of scientific fraud. It's shocking to find that somebody one thought was a great scientist was deliberately misleading. What Haeckel did was to take a human embryo and copy it, pretending that the salamander and the pig and all the others look the same at the same stage of development. They don't. These are fakes. Unquote, Dr. Michael Richardson, St. George's Medical School, London.
But what's really so unbelievable about this is that they still put this in textbooks. Now, I know that they were in textbooks 40 years ago when I was going to college. I suppose I look back, it seems like 40 years ago. Actually, it was 50 years ago that over 50 years ago I graduated from medical school, so this must have been close to 60 years ago, or at least 55 years ago. But are they still putting them in the textbooks today to confuse our young people and deceive them?
Well, Stan, much less so. They have been withdrawn from another a number of textbooks as this has gradually gotten attention as this matter has been more and more scientifically investigated. But there are still a number of high school and college textbooks that do include them. I wouldn't say that it's a pervasive teaching today, but I will say it's still pervasive in the public mind for people who saw those pictures like I did and were taught that as a fact.
And so this is all in the book, and in this book, The Case Against Darwin, you'll actually see that page out of the textbook that at least I had when I went to school, and I suspect many of our listeners may have seen exactly those same pictures. So a picture is burned into your mind. It's sort of like something you put on a computer. It's always there. And that's what they do. They use our textbooks, they use pictures to deceive our young people today. And the real reason that they do it is to turn them against God or to challenge their basic faith. What are some of the other things that you'd like to bring up?
Vestigial organs is one. You know, when I went to school, I was taught that we had these vestigial organs, these useless organs, or they were becoming useless, that were holdovers from our animal past. And it's interesting, in the Scopes trial, there was a zoologist named Horatio Hackett Newman who testified for Darrow. And he said this, quote, "There are no less than 180 vestigial structures in the human body, sufficient to make a man a walking museum of antiquities," unquote. Now, what were some of the organs they were calling useless at that time? Well, the thyroid, which we now know has an important role in metabolism. They said that the thymus gland found in the chest was useless. We now know it has an immune function. They said the pineal gland found in the brain was useless. We now know it secretes the hormone melatonin. Those vestigial structures are down from 180 to about zero. It just turns out that evolutionists at that time, Stan, assumed that if they didn't know what the function was of an organ, it had no function. But the fact of the matter is that God designed the human body with a function and a purpose, and I'm certainly glad that the medical profession did not stop studying the human body simply because they've been told these organs had no purpose.
Well, let's go to Mike, who's calling in. Is this Mike from Santa Cruz?
Yeah, Mike from Santa Cruz.
Hi, how are you doing, Mike?
Yeah, I wanted to ask about the way evolution is used to promote racism, since in the evolutionary model, the black man is supposedly a transitional form between the chimpanzee and the white man.
Well, I don't know that anybody is pushing that today. Have you ever heard anything like that, James?
Well, I've certainly heard it many times, and I could give you some quotes. Thomas Huxley, we mentioned him, one of our guests, callers mentioned Thomas Huxley, Darwin's bulldog. Here's what he wrote. He was the chief advocate of Darwinism in the 19th century. He said, quote, "It may be quite true that some Negroes are better than some white men, but no rational man believes the average Negro is the equal of the white man. And if this be true, it is simply incredible that when his disabilities are removed and a relative has a fair field, he'll be able to compete successfully with his bigger-brained rival. The highest places within civilization will assuredly not be within the reach of our dusky cousins," unquote, Thomas Huxley. Now, 57 years after that quote was made, a chart of human evolution was put together at the American Museum of Natural History, which I have in my book, Tornado in a Junkyard, and it was put together by the museum, and it showed a sequence of human evolution with our common ancestors, the apes. It shows the apes splaying off on the right side into gibbons, chimpanzees, hold on 1 second. I'll just bring up this picture on my own end of the phone here. Orangutans and gorillas, and on the left-hand side, you see they start with Piltdown Man, the fraud, number one. Goes up to number eight, they label Australian, which means Australian Aborigine. Number nine, they label Negro. Number ten, Chinese. Number 11 at the top, they have the skull of what they label white. Now, I should point out, Stan, that this is not what evolutionists are saying today, but it is an example of some of the social tragedies that evolution has brought about by reducing man to nothing more than an animal.
And placing the black man as inferior to the white man.
Well, there still are people and within the elitists who do that today. And certainly if you read the writings of some of the, Margaret Sanger might be an example, who was funded by the Rockefellers. She was very much of a racist, and she even wrote in some of her writings, and quoted, I have them quoted in my Population Control's Jenna monograph, about how, we wouldn't want the Negroes to find out we were trying to eliminate them, so we'll use the ministers to allay that thought, if any of the more unruly ones get the idea that we really want to eliminate them. And the thing is, they really do want to eliminate them. That is one of the goals of population control. And we should be furious, but nobody ever wants to talk about it. So I think it's a good point, Mike.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, God bless. Thanks. And so if you want to give us a call, we've got time for one more call. Number 464-8295, our 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest is James Perloff, and we're talking about, well, this evening, the case against Darwin, and then if you want the encyclopedia, it's Tornado in a Junkyard. And but they're both excellent summaries of what's going on. The beauty of the case against Darwin is it's easy reading. It gives you a lot of the major facts. And then, of course, if you want to get in much more detail, then you go to the 300-page book, The Case Against Darwin. Well, certainly we see all of these things and the lie about the vestigial organs. What about the tail? We often hear, oh, well, man had a tail.
Well, you know, it's sometimes you see the National Enquirer, one of those type of tabloids, and it'll have a picture of a baby with a superimposed tail, and it says, monkey boy is born. And it is true that once in a while children are born with growth on their tailbones, and this has been explained over the years as the human race still has some tail genes. These children are holdovers from the monkeys, they're from the ape stage, when we were apes swinging from trees. Well, I'd just like to quote Dr. A. Rendell Short, professor of surgery, University of Bristol. Quote, it is often stated that children are born with tails, but as a rule, the alleged tails are nothing but fatty or fibrous tumors, such as may be met with in many parts of the body without any embryological significance.
Okay, let's go to Gloria calling from Spokane. Hi, Gloria.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment. Mike had called in, and he was on the right track because Charles Darwin was, in fact, a racist. In fact, his original title to his book was The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life.
Okay, thank you very much.
You bet.
Okay. That was Gloria calling from Spokane, and yes, I think that probably Mike was right on, because there really are people out there, the sort of elite, who believe that they are superior to all the rest of us, and specifically the other racist groups. Well, we're about out of time, James. Do you have any other thoughts, parting thoughts for our listeners tonight?
Just that this is really a significant issue. It's not just a quote-unquote science issue. The faith of millions of people in Western society has been wrecked by the teaching of Darwin's theory of evolution as a fact. Okay, once kids lose their faith in God, that's when they go down the road of being moral relativists like I did. And the thing I want to stress tonight is that there's so much evidence out there against Darwin's theory of evolution. Sure, it's not being taught in public schools. You try and challenge Darwin's theory of evolution in public schools, they'll say you're trying to introduce religion to the schools, you're violating church and state, which is a whole other subject, and a whole bunch of rubbish. But I want to stress the fact there's no reason why any child today has to have happened to them what happened to me and become an atheist because they're taught the theory of evolution. The theory of evolution is really being discredited today, and there's so many facts against it today. And it's just a matter of equipping young people with them.
And Joe, what we need to do is get the facts for our young people and let them realize that they're being lied to in the public schools. If you love your kids, get them out of the public schools. If you can't, at least get the information so they'll understand that so much of what they're being told is religion. That's the religion of Darwin, not the religion of Christianity. James, thanks so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure having you on.
And thank you, Stan. You're a great host, and I really appreciate it. This is about the 17th time I've been on your show, and I really want to thank you.
Well, it's always a pleasure. God bless, and we'll have you on again before too long. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, well, that was James Perloff, and I hope you've enjoyed the program, as I always enjoy having James on with us. Well, this is the time when we once again have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you agree that there is a problem, if you recognize that behind everything going on is that eternal battle between good and evil that began before the dawn of civilization and persists to this very day. And our job is to try to get people to think. And that's one of the hardest things in the world to do. But, if we can get people beginning to listen to our programs, and we try to provide interesting guests, but there's a common theme. I'm sure if you listen regularly, you realize we're trying to convince you we're in a battle to determine whether this nation or any nation under God can long survive. Because there is a conspiracy against God today, working at the highest echelons of our government and the governments of all of the rest of the world. Well, we'll be back again tomorrow. Until then, pray for America. Pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please remember to pray for my ministry Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. So until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you. Good evening. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming here from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Calls for a moment. We have our usual guests. We'll have Randy Thomason, we'll have Brad Dacus on, and then we'll have John Leffler, our very good friend, and we're going to be talking about, well, all sorts of fascinating things. You won't want to miss that call. But right now, let's go to Randy, calling us from up there in Sacramento, that den of iniquity. Randy, I was concerned this last week when I saw that Governor Schwarzenegger wants to borrow money at a higher rate than the Democrats for a longer period of time. And if we were to have the bonds as Governor Schwarzenegger wants, why did it cost us $4 or $5 billion more than the Democrats? What's going on?
Yeah, it was real interesting. As I opened this morning's newspapers, still we had a Republican wanting to borrow $15 billion, which costs about $1 billion in interest a year to pay off the interest there, and a Democrat assemblywoman saying, hey, let's give the state controller more auditing powers to ferret out waste. So what's the direction? Do we ferret out waste? Do we say, let's cut spending? Or, massively, or do we say, no, we can't do that, the hole's too big, we're really in an emergency situation, we need to borrow huge sums of money. I think there ought to be a lot of cutting first.
Well, I agree with you. In fact, the thing that really bothers me is, so instead of cutting, we're going to borrow $15 billion so that we can pay the all the salaries and everything else this year. What happens next year? Now, we borrowed the $15 billion. We're going to be just hell. We're over indebted right now, but we borrow another $15 billion. What do you do next year if we still have another $15 billion deficit? Do we borrow another $15 billion? At what point do you start cutting back on state services?
Right, right. Well, it's exactly the point. You're exactly right. You can't just keep borrowing and borrowing and borrowing. That's total bankruptcy, and it actually leads to a worse government, because then they say, okay, the solution is not tightening our belt or actually killing off certain programs. There'll be more temptation for the government to tax you and me. And so really what we need to have is some complete wipeout of some programs. It's pretty interesting. We all like beaches, we like the environment, etc. But you know, we have an awful lot of waste. There's a state and a federal environmental protection agency. Well, the federal one is good enough. It's not worth it to have a state duplicitous type of agency run by liberals, and they are really, I think, going against the respect and dignity of people by placing certain plants and certain animals above people in the hierarchy of values.
Well, I remember Tom McClintock, when I interviewed him, said that for one of the first things he would do would be to do away with all the duplications of agencies. Why have a federal agency and a state agency? He said if he did away with all the state agencies, he could clear it, I think, and I may be mistaken, but I remember, I think he was talking about $14 billion. That was the first place he was going to begin, you know, saving money, was doing away with all the duplicate agencies, not accomplishing anything, simply being used to harass our people. But Arnold obviously isn't going to do that, nor is he going to challenge the $20 billion of illegal contracts that were negotiated by Gray Davis's personal aide, who was being paid by the state to negotiate with the power companies, and just happened to be working for the power companies at the same time, which some people might think was a conflict of interest, but obviously Arnold doesn't think so, because he's going to let that $20 billion stand, he's going to enrich the power companies and impoverish the people. And it's sort of the money of taking money from poor people in a rich state to give to rich corporations in a poor state.
Yes, and as we talked last time, you know, it'd be better to cancel those energy contracts rather than renegotiate them. Bad things just ought to be done away with. Here's how it sets up at the legislature. You've got the Democrats who are, by and large, they don't want to cut spending. They don't want spending limits. But it was interesting in the last negotiations, they were willing to have some type of limit on the bond measure, a more conservative limit than Schwarzenegger had himself. But by and large, you've got the Democrats who don't want a spending cap. On the Republican aisle, you've got some big government Republicans and some small government Republicans, mostly smaller government. Then you've got Arnold sort of in the middle saying, well, remember during the election, the campaign, he said, well, we've got to bring jobs back in California. We've got to get the economy back in California. Business has got to come back. Why? So we can pay for all these programs and stuff, he said. Well, I think what's going on is the education of Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's done some good things, like gotten rid of the tripling of the car tax. That's what all the candidates, major candidates, said they would do. Well, he got elected, so he did it. And he said that he's going to want to review all of the policies and regulations that Governor Gray Davis did. And so I hope that he reviews the energy contract. I hope that he reviews the adoption policies that were bad under Davis. But I think what's going on is an education where he didn't get what he wanted. He was handed a major defeat, and he's going to have to decide what's going to go to the ballot. It'll be Arnold Schwarzenegger trying to do a private ballot initiative, probably for the bond, probably also for the spending cap. But there's still some negotiations going on at the Capitol behind the scenes, and it sounds like Schwarzenegger is getting a little more conservative, a little more realistic, even suggesting a suspension of Prop 98, it seems. Now, Prop 98 guarantees 40% of the state budget goes to the government schools. Well, there's tons of waste in the schools programs. That needs to be reformed. So he's mentioning something he's never mentioned before, and that's causing the education establishment to get a little jittery.
Well, good for him, Arnold. I hope he'll follow through with that. And I'll tell you what, we keep getting faxes every day from the prison guards. They're afraid that he's going to start cutting back on the number of guards there, and maybe even starting doing something about the excessive number of people in our prisons.
Well, you know, again, there's waste in all parts of government, including the prisons. And if you're a prison guard listening, I appreciate what you got going there. The prison guard union hates the thought of privatizing prisons. They hate the government hates the thought of anything getting out of their control. Well, you know what? Private schools, by and large, treat parents and children better than government schools. Federal Express does a better job than the U.S. Postal Service, and private industry will usually do a better job providing goods or services than the government will. And so we had to look at privatization of a lot of things, because when the government hires someone to do a job, the government's still in control, so the people's vote still matters. But you gotta hire the best workers, and that means sometimes just breaking out of the old system and saying we're gonna reform and do things right. That's really cleaning house. And so I'm sort of glad when the government unions get nervous, because that means that maybe there's some reform coming down the pike.
Okay, fine. Well, now, what issues would you like to leave with our listeners this evening?
Well, first of all, I want to say that children need a mother and a father. They fare best. We know this. Now, why are we talking about this? Well, we've mentioned it before. The adoption policy needs to be changed. Gray Davis allowed unmarried couples and homosexual couples to adopt children. That is not in the best interest of the children. That's in the special interest of these left-wing groups. We need to have a pro-family adoption policy, and I would encourage you to call Governor Schwarzenegger and leave a message on his answering machine. You can do this starting tomorrow morning. Call him at 916-445-2841. 916-445-2841, and just say, give adopted children a married mom and dad, a married mother and father. That's what adopted children need. He has it within his power to do that. A real easy way to send a message, and you can do that anytime, 24 hours a day. Just visit our website, savecalifornia.com. At savecalifornia.com, you can go and send an email message to Governor Schwarzenegger. It's a pre-written message. It's got all the details, and we've got lots of people enjoying doing that.
Okay, God bless. Anything you want to get your don't have a telephone number. They have your website, savecalifornia.com.
That's
any
the
other
main
thoughts?
Place.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the main place, and I just want to wish everybody a joyous Christmas. Remember the reason for the season. It is Jesus Christ, who was born on traditionally on Christmas Day. We're not sure what day that was, but we mark it with this season. So when you see Christmas lights, think about the one who is representing God, God in the flesh, and he is the light of the world and the light for all who would look to him. So that's what I want to say as we get into the busy Christmas season. Let's focus on the real meaning and resist what the world would say, that trinkets will satisfy. No, they won't. Peace in our hearts with the one who made us will really satisfy.
Amen. Bye-bye. God bless.
Thank you, Dr.
Okay. That was Randy Thomason from Campaign for California Families and his website, savecalifornia.com. Well, next we're going to have Brad Dacus with us. And as you know, Brad Dacus is the president of the Pacific Justice Institute. And they're out there defending Christians all over the Western states on issues where Christians are coming under religious persecution. Now, they don't take property cases. That would be the Pacific Justice Institute. But unless you're a church, they're being blocked as far as doing development, things of that sort. There was a Christian school that wanted to buy a hospital, and it was a closed hospital. A fellow had owned the hospital, wanted to sell it. The Christian college wanted to buy it. And the local people said, oh, no, we might need a hospital again sometime in the distant future. You can't sell, you can't buy. And they went to bat, and, of course, eventually they found out that the local community didn't have the right to tell the man who owned the hospital what he could do with it, or that he could not could sell that to a Christian college. So there are all these things out there that really is Christian bigotry, I should, anti-Christian bigotry on the part of many people within government. And it's about time that we begin to limit overzealous use of power by local governments. Well, Brad apparently is not answering his, so maybe we can just go right ahead and see if we can get John Loeffler on the line. If Brad is not going to be available, why, we'll just go to our next guest. So, try once more, and if you don't get him, we'll just go ahead and get John on the line. And I talked to John today. Those of you who listen to our programs regularly, know that John Loeffler is one of the smartest people we have on our side, and he does work with Jim Poplava, who was a money manager, one of these people who are very, very successful managing other people's money, and they do a radio program on a weekly basis. And Jim Poplava has written about the perfect financial storm, a sort of a takeoff on that movie we had with George Clooney not too long ago. But the perfect financial storm is what we're having today with the situation developing with massive federal deficits and, of course, very inadequate industrial base here in the United States, and massive federal debt, massive balance of trade deficit. All of these things are moving America towards a crisis situation. Now, you look at the stock market and, gee, it doesn't look so bad, but you have to realize it's being manipulated. It's against the law, but who are you going to hold guilty or who are you going to hold responsible when the government breaks the law? And there's nobody to go to. So they're manipulating the stock market. Why? Because it all has to do with perception. It has to do with what you think is going on. And when the stock market goes up, don't you really feel better? And when the stock market goes down, don't you feel sort of depressed and down in the dumps? And we see this reflected in the little mail order business that we have. And when the times are good, as they would appear to be at the present time, why, people are getting things, they're buying books and products and buying Christmas presents. And when times are bad, they're hanging on to their money. They have just as much money in both instances, but they are going to be very reluctant to part with it. So we're seeing right now that they've convinced the American people that things are really pretty good. And you read these reports in the paper why American production is up 30% over, but they don't tell you what it's up over 30% from. Well, it's over 30% from last year. But last year, a lot of these companies weren't producing hardly anything. And if you actually very carefully analyze these figures, you find out who's making all the money. Why, the banks are making the money. I mean, they're making money hand over fist. But then when you get around to what's happening with the chip makers and with our industries, they're really doing very, very poorly. And if you look and see what's really happening, this is a jobless recovery. Oh, yes, there may be a few more jobs coming in now because it's the Christmas season and they're hoping people are going to be out there buying a lot. But what are they buying? Well, they're buying products that are made in Japan, and they're buying products that are made in China and in South Korea and Malaysia. But they're not making that many things that are buying those many things made in the United States. Well, who do we have on the line?
You have John Loeffler, I think.
John Loeffler. Well, how is John Loeffler tonight?
Well, we're sitting here bouncing around, waiting for a white Christmas. You know, that's the best part of it.
Are you on a cell phone? Your voice is just a little...
I'm on a cell phone. How does it sound?
All right. Well, it's like halitosis. It's better than no breath at all. you don't have a hard line there someplace, do you?
Well, I did have one. Sometimes this actually works better. But I tell you what, let me see here. I can go find a hard line.
Would you mind?
No problem.
Okay, fine. Now, well, we had John Loeffler, and now we don't have John Loeffler anymore, but he'll be back very, very soon. And we're going to be talking, I think, about what's happening financially. When John and I get on together, we don't necessarily have a fixed agenda. Certainly, there are a lot of things happening as far as the Middle East is concerned, our relationships with other countries, globalization program, which is shipping our jobs and our factories overseas. It's all being done intentionally. Of course, they know exactly what they're doing, but they don't want the American people to understand what this agenda is really all about. Well, let's try that. John, are you there?
Well, let's see if it sounds any better this way.
Well, I really think it does. At least it sounds like you got out of the barrel.
No, it's fun in the barrel. I don't have to face reality that way.
All right. Well, anyway, of course, we've talked earlier today, and you were just talking about Jim Poplava. And you said that you had done an interview with a gentleman who had written a book or an article about, what is it, the $44 trillion, what is it, debacle?
No, he calls it abyss.
Abyss, the $44 billion abyss. $44 trillion, I'm sorry. $44 trillion. How much is $44 trillion? I can't imagine.
Oh, it just boggles the brain. It's up in the 10 to the, let's see, billion, trillion is to the 12. And you can only deal with it in exponents. You can't deal with it in anything that resembles reality. But when you realize the national debt right now, well, it depends on who you talk to and what you factor in, but it's only running somewhere between, what, 7 and 13 trillion. We're talking about $44 trillion that we have to cough up in the next 10 years.
Now, this would then be for our Social Security and Medicare liability, as well as all the other pensions that we promised to pay to the congressmen and federal employees, things like that?
Yeah, that type of thing. Basically, if you were in a private corporation and say you had all of these retirement plans that you knew in 10 years you were going to have to fund, you would have to begin escrowing funds into those accounts so that when they came to maturity and you had to start paying into them, then somebody, that you'd be able to pay them. If you didn't, I mean, they'd throw you in the slammer on lack of fiduciary responsibility and fraud. Well, the very thing they'd put you in jail for is exactly what our government is doing. And basically we have this was discovered by Professor Larry Kotlikoff. You need to have the background of this. There's an article in Fortune magazine this month called The $44 Trillion Abyss by Professor Kotlikoff. But last fall, Secretary of Treasury Paul O'Neill finally came down and at least asked the very thorny and difficult, honest question, was the nation prepared to pay all of its future bills? And there were two experts that worked for months to calculate the answer. When they finally got to the bottom line, they were absolutely flabbergasted. They didn't even expect it. And the Bush administration spiked this story. They replaced John O'Neill and they put in Paul O'Neill and put in John Snow, who was a more of a political ball player. When you understand that the quantity of arrearedness here is staggering, now you also need to remember as we talk about it that this is only one part of the oncoming financial problems that we're going to face here. We have derivatives issues, we have a looming recession, but just funding these pension plans, these Social Security and Medicare, and we've just voted through the prescription benefit program through, will require just an immense amount of money. Raising the income tax, all the other taxes, the payroll taxes, 95%, virtually doubling the payroll taxes, and we're already close to somewhere between about a 30% tax rate, which could double real fast in terms of the future, or raising taxes across the board 75% to deal with this. Now, there are some proposals. Professor Kotlikoff, he said he almost feels it's too late to do anything about it, and definitely neither the Republicans nor the Democrats want to do anything about it, but Stan, it's almost on our doorstep.
I know it is, and when we keep telling people this, they sort of look at you and say, I just don't believe that. I mean, if things are that bad, Rush Limbaugh would tell us.
You really think that?
Somebody just called in and said, wouldn't the easiest thing to do be just to have national bankruptcy?
Well, ironically, I actually think that, believe it or not, and of course I'm not an expert, when you realize that this debt is a paper debt, and that the debt, although 50% of the debt right now, see, is owned to foreign hands. And the thing gets really complicated. If you just sort of finally admit it's all a paper debt and discharge it, you could probably solve the issue, or at least a lot of the crises. But, you know, when have you ever known the establishment to take it in the shorts for the things that their policies have done?
Well, I think we're seeing this Medicare bill. Now, Tom DeLay wrote an article, which I have in that editorial in the Washington Times, and he said, look, we've got one chance. If we don't get the Medicare bill through, the whole thing is going to collapse. And so we've got to get the Medicare bill through because it's the only way we're going to be able to preserve Medicare, or at least preserve some form of health, national health care for the elderly. And so what they've really done with this Medicare bill, and forget about the drugs, because the drugs is simply, I believe, a smokescreen for what this is really all about. They want to force many of our senior citizens into HMOs so that they can have rationed health care. The government doesn't want to ration health care. They want private corporations to, because if the government rations health care, people will get mad at them. But if the private corporations do, then you can get mad at the private corporations, but you don't blame the politicians. And yet the politicians have created a system that is financially untenable. It started out with $500 million a year. $500 million. The idea was, I think, by 1985, it was going to cost, I don't know, $6 or $8 billion a year. It was costing about $40 billion a year by that time. And this last year, $256 billion. That isn't sustainable.
It's never been sustainable since the day FDR started the whole thing rolling forward and Lyndon Johnson perpetuated it. That's why it always makes me giggle when I hear about the Democrats are complaining because the war in Iraq is just creating such a horrible deficit and all this. And I go, oh, don't even give me that. You know, for the last 30 years, Democratic Congresses have been running up massive arrearages that just far turn anything pale to where we are. They've all got their hand in the till.
But we've never had a federal deficit, a planned deficit of $750 billion. I mean, certainly, even Ronald Reagan at his worst only ran up a debt of $200 billion a year. Next year, George Bush is going to run up a national debt of $750 billion in 1 year. Jimmy Carter, it took him 4 years to run up a debt of $200 billion. Ronald Reagan was accomplished it in a year, and George Bush is going to get $750 billion. That's $750 billion, almost four times what Reagan did at his worst in 1 year. This is just going to be a disaster.
I mean, and this is just one issue. In other words, we are just so far off the scale, and because of the failure to use some kind of accrual accounting at the federal level, not to mention the amount of off-budget accounting. In other words, unofficial liabilities that have been put on sideline issues that nevertheless we're going to have to fill. We really have a very difficult time assessing at a glance what it is we're going to owe. And of course, understand that the younger generation of today, we have an inverted pyramid. Within 5 years, the baby boomers start retiring. And they're going to, this is the first generation that has paid into Social Security all of their working lives. Before that, people picked up some point in their careers and began paying into it. This group started working and paid it right from the start. They're going to get their Mother Hubbard's covers bid. That's the first one. The second one is, you know, we cracked through, the Dow went through 10,000 earlier today. And of course, the champagne corks were popping on Wall Street as they're trying to tell everybody this is a recovery. It's not. It's one of the rallies I think you and I talked about a while back in the process of a bull market. No bull market goes straight down. Bear market goes straight down. No bull market goes straight up. And you have a series of dipsy-doodles. It's the same thing as an airplane, which is on the way to the ground, left alone. It'll dipsy-doodle on the way down. And we're still sliding down into a very big depression. They're talking about this recovery, but we never discharged any debt. We're not seeing an increase of jobs. Now we're talking about a jobless recovery. You work this one out. It is such double talk. Coming out of the national media pundits, we keep hearing about XYZ Corporation beat estimates. And who gives a flying twaddle? You know, I mean, they can estimate anything they want. All I want to know is if they make a profit or a loss. And to that, they'll say, well, we sort of blah, blah, blah. What was that? Well, we sort of blah, 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 you know. So, that's the second thing, is we're heading into this depression. We have derivative liabilities of just incredible proportions.
Now, you better explain to our listeners what a derivative is, because this is what Warren Buffett had referred to as the financial weapons of mass destruction.
It basically is. Anybody who has a moral conscience, that's what I think when we talked to Professor Kotlikoff last week, he said if you have a moral conscience, you see what's happening, and it's virtually financial terrorism. Derivatives are very difficult to explain as far as if you're not into finances. Basically, they are monetary instruments that are based on the value of underlying instruments, groups of various monetary instruments that may shift in value. And the bottom line on a derivative is you can make an astounding amount of money in a single day if you bet the right way. It's like an organized bet. And you can also lose a dramatic amount of money in the very same day, just like Orange County, California did a few years back. Now, our banks, even the major banks, have hideous exposures to derivatives. J.P. Morgan Chase is probably the most overexposed bank. And it has, I think the last time I checked, its derivatives exposure against its assets were 7 to 1. So that means if this thing goes kaplooey, and just the odds of it mean sooner or later it has to go kaplooey. If it goes kaplooey, it's got a 7-to-1 exposure, which means six sevenths isn't going to get paid out of this whole thing. And then ultimately, when we look at the what's going to have to happen is the politicians, I'll just be honest with you, are not going to want to deal with this whole Medicare Social Security issue. They will continue putting it off until some future politician is in power. The Congress people, their pensions are funded, so they will not be affected, just everyone else. They are not going to deal with this, and so the only thing left for the Fed to do will be to begin printing money like there's no tomorrow.
And with that, of course, the value of people's CDs, pension funds, annuities, bank accounts, everything is destroyed in an inflationary spiral.
Right. It's all going to collapse. In other words, it will be robbing from everybody's efforts at saving to save what was already a doomed system. We're literally paying, Dr. Stan, for what generations before us have already spent. That's what we're doing.
And right now, of course, we're borrowing from our great-grandchildren. That's what this whole Medicare bill is this drug benefits. Well, we're going to be back here in just a minute with our good friend, John Loeffler, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, John Loeffler. We're talking about his recent interview with Professor, was it Kotlikoff, is it?
Kotlikoff.
And what does the professor think that can be done about this $44 trillion abyss?
Well, as far as the Social Security, he said, if you're going to try to take a swat at it, he says the best thing you could do is to have a national sales tax. Because he said at least that lets some of the wealthier retired people help offset the cost of it through means of their purchases and other things like that. As far as Medicaid, he's in favor of a voucher-type system that would give, each year you'd be rated on what your medical needs and things were. So say somebody who's suffering from some kind of catastrophic illness gets a high-level voucher and other people get a low-level voucher, that would make an incentive for the insurance companies to also insure people who have high medical needs because of the fact that they would be bringing in higher vouchers, et cetera. And he said what that does is that slows down the whole process. Basically, his plan is to try to depressurize the debt slowly without letting the system come into collapse. But he's not naive about this whole thing, Dr. Stan. He was pretty sanguine, and he says he's pretty much an upbeat guy. I remember them telling us that, but he said, I'm pretty much an upbeat guy, but given the fact that politicians just refuse to deal with this issue, they will most likely allow it to go to a crisis stage.
Well, we already begin to see very, very subtly the skyrocketing of prices in the precious metals market. Gold was 407 today. Silver was pushing towards 545. Platinum almost to $800 an ounce. So we're seeing all of the precious metals going up, and I'm not certain whether that represents the depreciation of the dollar or the beginning of the collapse of the economic system. What do you think?
Well, that's going to be an interesting question. That's why Jim sort of refers to it as the perfect financial storm. And what he is saying is we have all of these different things hitting. And the one thing that's really clear out of the whole thing is while you can inflate your way into some kind of artificial prosperity, no amount of control by a central bank can ultimately prevent the consequences of it. He said that's a naive dream if you think that that can happen. And I think that's what they're discovering right now. They've come up with newer and more creative ways to begin injecting what they call liquidity into the system. But let's face it, every time you inject liquidity, prices go up. And look what's happening. Have you been to the store lately and looked at the prices? So, you know, the only reason I talk about this is I don't really believe it's going to be gotten under control. As a matter of fact, I think there are some interests in the world that would like to see it not under control, because in this chaos you can get all sorts of programs through that people wouldn't even think about earlier on. And I think it will go to some kind of crisis head. But the interesting thing is we've got so many different facets, whether it's the coming deficit as far as social transfer payments, whether it's derivatives, whether it's the collapsing value of the dollar. We don't know how these are all going to interact, Dr. Stan. That's the funny part, is we've never been out in this kind of an exposed situation before. And there are competitors now for the dollar. Remember, there are people in the world determined to bring the U.S. down.
Well, I think that that really is one of the biggest factors that everybody's ignoring. First of all, I think that the Europeans would like to take over the leadership of the world. We've helped them. We've helped create the European Union. We've encouraged this largest economic bloc in the whole world. It's going to be about almost a half a billion people in the reconstituted European Union. And yet, of course, I believe that France and Germany would love to see the economic leadership of the world transferred from the United States to the euro. I believe that the Chinese would like to bring us down. I believe that the Muslim world looks upon us, 1.25 billion people there, look upon America as the reason for their second-class citizenship, the impoverishment of Muslims throughout the world. Why? Because we've kept dictators in power in the Muslim countries, and it was to our interest to have dictators there, but that, of course, has really continued to oppress the individual, and they feel that we are exploiting their countries for our purposes, and I'd have to say I rather agree with that. We've kept the Saudi kingdom in power, so we wanted their oil. And they have oppressed the people. They've been pushing Wahhabism and this radical form of Islam all throughout the Islamic world. And we've gone right along with it because we wouldn't want to upset our good friends, the bin Laden family and the king and the royal family of Saudi Arabia. So there is a blowback. There are consequences for what you do. And I agree with you. I believe that the Muslims would love to see America come down. I think that the Chinese, I think that the Europeans would. And I'm not sure in our current situation, I believe we are not only economically bankrupt, I think we're morally bankrupt.
I think so. And moral bankruptcy always seems to precede financial bankruptcy historically. So, and these things tend to have a, you know, I'm not pessimistic in terms of us individually, because I think, you know, first of all, I think you have the Lord, and God always promises to provide no matter what. And countries have gone through these things before. But the reason I talk about them is so that people understand that this is really the picture. Now, once you know what the picture really is, then you can take some preparations and some directions for your own life, because we're going to have to survive through these times. And the one thing we're not getting out of the mainline media is anything that's really true. You just don't.
Well, the only thing that we can get really that's accurate, I think, is the alternative media, a few of the websites out there that ordinarily we can trust, even those, some of my favorite conservative internet sites, I think sometimes get stuck with CIA disinformation articles.
Right, and the hard part, as you well know, is to wade through all of this and begin figuring out what's chaff and nonsense and what is real. That's always the hard part for what we do, because it's what I call the politically correct side. That's the mainline story, and it's just not true. Every night I can find things on the tube I don't know if you do it. I wind up yelling at the television, so I don't watch a lot of this stuff a lot, because I know it's wrong. And I don't know it's not only wrong, it's deliberately wrong, that somebody's misleading here. But the flip side of that is, you're right, there's a pile of disinformation, there's a pile of stupid information out there written by people who really just don't know what they're talking about. And somehow you have to be able to sift through that and put together an accurate picture. That's what makes what we do rather difficult.
Well, our telephone number is 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. If you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment about what John is suggesting, that we're in real economic trouble. But I think he's sugarcoating it a little bit. I think it's a lot worse than he's saying. Under any circumstances, we really are having a real problem in America today, because our people are confused. They're being confused by, I believe, the church growth movement, which is changing the nature of God And we're told, of course, in the latter days, there's going to be a great falling away from the scriptures. And when you see what Rick Warren has done with the scriptures in his book, The Purpose-Driven Life, and how he has gone very selectively to certain very odd translations to come up with the conclusion that he wants, he's changed the nature of God. And once, of course, you've destroyed the fundamentals of faith, you destroy the nation. It was Whitaker Chambers who said that human societies, like human beings, live on faith. And if you destroy faith, why, you destroy human society. And I think that that is coming at a rapid rate. And right here in the United States, which until recently was the bulwark of Christendom for the entire world.
Yeah, and if you notice that you're right about one thing, the attack is always on faith and belief, which also affects our freedom, because there's a freedom of choice. Anything else brings you into bondage. Remember over the old concentration camp at Auschwitz, it said, Arbeit macht frei, and that means work sets you free. That's a lie. The scripture says that. In other words, it's faith that sets us free. But the bottom line of the whole thing is you're right. There would come a time in the end times when people would kill you, Jesus said, thinking that they were doing a holy act for God. Well, how could they get to that point? Well, there's a distortion of what truth is and what error is, and from the spiritual perspective, you take God's word as being the source of truth. And we began that whole process, if you recall, almost a century ago when we began undermining what we believe about the word of God, about the scriptures, and we began picking and choosing and smorgasbording our way through it, saying some of it was this, some of it was allegory, and you can only take this. And finally, you know, in the Jesus Project, they were going to get together all the left-wing crowd that had got into relative values and things of that nature, and they were trying to figure out exactly what it was Jesus said. What could they agree on that Jesus had actually said in the New Testament? I think it was only one or two lines they could finally agree on. So whenever I hear people talking like this, and most of the mainline churches believe it, right? The question I'd like to ask them is, well, okay, assuming that's true, when does God stop lying to us? Okay, and I use that word lying because it really has an important implication. And the implication is, if you can't believe certain things out of the scriptures, then how do you know what you can believe? When it talks about our fallen nature, or that Jesus was the Son of God, or that he died for us and rose, where do you start and where do you stop? And indeed, in a time of trial and persecution, Richard Vorenbrand pointed out that none of the pastors who believed in this modernist or revisionist theology, whatever you want to call it, there's several names for it, none of those people were able to stand up under imprisonment and torture. Because he said, how could you suffer and or die or be in prison for a Christ whom you weren't sure existed? You weren't sure that he was the Son of God. You weren't sure that God existed. You weren't sure that there was a resurrection. As a matter of fact, you weren't really sure about what you were sure about. Would you want to suffer and die for somebody like that or be tortured? No. And so thereupon, and the world right now is warring against that. That's what the whole consensus process is all about. You were talking about Rick Warren. Well, the whole church growth, the purpose growth church movement is based on this consensus process, which teaches you to have shifting values based on current norms and relationships, rather than to have firm values and to understand what it is you believe and contrast everything against that. That today is mocked as being closed-minded, unadaptable to change, these type of things.
It's really very interesting, that comment. Edward Hunter, who analyzed the brainwashing techniques were used by the communists during the Korean War, pointed out that it was young men from the South with without a lot of education, but with a basic belief in God and in Christianity that had been inculcated them from their families, managed to hold up under the pressure of torture and the brainwashing much better than boys from the North who'd been to college and had their faith challenged, and they didn't know quite what they did believe. And those with the simple faith came through this fine. And those with no faith at all simply crumbled under the pressure. And we have a wonderful tape. We call it Brainwashing. It's the story of a Reverend Millen who was in China at the time of the communist takeover. And he talks about what happened to him when the communists arrested him, and they arrested a couple of Catholic priests and a couple of liberal missionaries, And some of them went mad under the pressure. He was in pretty poor shape when he got all the way done. But his faith kept him intact. And he actually was able to convert some of the guards there to Christianity because of his fact that he knew what he believed in. He held to it no matter what they did to him. And the others, some of them simply went mad.
Yeah, and that's the whole nature. And today, the world calls extremist anybody who has a hard belief system, meaning I believe certain things can be true, other things regarded as not true. There is a right and a wrong, etc. And yet at the same time, the world, which is preaching that we shouldn't have those values, preaches those its own values absolutely. So this is the inherent contradiction. But what I call it is militant mediocrity, because it is urging that people become mediocre in their own beliefs, and if you don't wish to do that, it becomes militant about enforcing that mediocrity upon you. And thereupon is the war of faith. Because look at how many people, let's take an example, zoom in on the Episcopalian Church. I don't believe the Church's treatment of homosexuals and how it's dealt with the whole issue has been very good. But on the flip side of that is, the Scripture's pretty clear on this whole issue. You know, you could lay out a lot of Scriptures. There's a certain moral section and a certain moral not. Why is it that we're even having this row going on within the Episcopalian Church? Well, the reason is because over the last 50 years, or better, we have had this questioning of the Scriptures and the right and wrong and the doubt going on in there. And you've watched this debasement go on through most of the mainline denominations, the Methodist Church, the Episcopalian Church, the Presbyterian Church. As each one allowed this little worm to get loose inside of itself, they slowly but surely, especially when it came to J. Gresham Machen and the Presbyterian Church, they were able to throw out the people who were trying to adhere to what you would call a biblical position.
It sounds like the church growth movement.
It's exactly the same thing. Anyone who sits here, now, I'll be honest with you, there is such a thing as bigotry or extreme narrowness within any type of religious belief, including the belief that everybody should be tolerant. There are narrow-minded, tolerant people out there. All right. But the bottom line is that every time this has ever been challenged, let's take Germany, for example, when the nature of Christianity was challenged in Hitler's Germany, only a small group of pastors said, we cannot accept this. You have polluted Christian doctrine. And everybody sort of forgets about Nazism when it came in. It wasn't viewed as the great big evil that we see looking back. It was viewed as the salvation of Germany at the time. People were carried away with the zeitgeist of the time. And as a result of that, very few people understood the transitions that were in progress and what that would entail. And so a small group of Christians had to pull aside and restate in the Barman Declaration what was true faith for them. There's always this group that pulls back at every moment, and they're not reactionary, they're simply maintaining faith and adhering to the position in those things which are essential. Ironically, that's what the word fundamentalist first came to mean. Now it has all sorts of pejorative meanings. What it meant early on, and this came out of the battle inside the Presbyterian Church, was what are the fundamentals of the Christian faith that everyone has to believe in order to be called Christian? You know, what it is that we must agree on, and all of the rest is peripherals. And that's what the word originally came to mean. But the time is coming. The pressure, you know, I talked to Barrett Chose a few weeks ago about the whole switch of even what the definitions of mental health is. And people who believe things firmly, contrary to the position of the common view of any given moment, and the common view is always shifting and changing, those people are mentally ill. You see, so even the definitions of mental health are coming to change to say that the people who believe, you know, there are three groups, Dr. Stan, we always knew had to go. Quranic Islam, Orthodox Judaism, and Biblical Christianity, or what I would call its counterpart with inside either Orthodox or Roman Catholicism, which has a corollary faithfulness not only to their version of the Scriptures, but also to their own traditional teachings and of the church. So those three groups have always had to go in the minds of all these globalists. Barbara Marx Hubbard talks about this. There's no lack of literature from Alice A. Bailey through Barbara Marx Hubbard talking about how these, and they name them all sorts of things, backward people, closed-minded people, those who haven't yet been enlightened, those who need to rethink their position, that need to be taken out of the off the planet, as Barbara Marx Hubbard said.
Now, those who will not evolve to a higher level of consciousness would certainly...
That's it. That's a good way of putting it. These are the backward people. But these claims, look, every time we've run into trouble in the world, these claims have always been made. We have a greater new world. Hitler made those claims. Karl Marx made those claims. Barbara Marx Hubbard is making those claims. You know, all of the New Age crowd, which has now, by the way, not disappeared. They've simply gone mainstream. They've slipped into the main organs of, they've gone from being what was thought to be a little cultish thing in the 80s. In the main line, they always proclaim that we're the great, the new, the higher envisioned, the more highly evolved, the tausendjähriges Reich, the thousand-year Reich. It's the same verbiage all over again. But again, most people, especially in the churches, Dr. Stan, we don't give it. You know, one of the things I challenge, I have a lot of affiliations with pastors and other people inside the Calvary Chapel movement. And Calvary Chapel has a principle of teaching verse by verse. Every Sunday, they go verse by verse through the scriptures. And they'll quote the verse about teaching verse by verse, precept upon precept. But I keep telling them, and this applies to all evangelical churches, you know, it's one thing to teach verse by verse, but when you say precept on precept, that doesn't mean the same as verse by verse. That means put the precepts together in some kind of a systemized organization so people understand what the Christian Weltanschauung is, the Christian worldview. And that is what is not happening in the evangelical churches. These people are literally standing naked before this onslaught of dialectical thought because they have not been taught inside their own churches the foundations of their faith and what Christian responses are. Just even, so it's not even so much what is being taught as the process of thought that is being taught, say, in the public schools or in this dialectical process, which is now flooding through everything in public life. And that's why people don't get it. That's why they have a gemisch, was the German term, in their minds, a mixture of this. And that's why, remember what you said earlier, they are confused. And in a time of trial, confusion is a very bad thing. Vornbraun said, before the time of trial ever comes upon your church in your country, you must know what it is you believe, because in the time of trial, that is not the time to figure it out.
Well, our job, your job and mine and those people, a small group of people who do have at least an opportunity to share our views with thousands of people across America, I really sometimes feel that we're preaching to the remnant. But we have an awesome responsibility to try to guide people, to prepare them for the difficult times that lie ahead, and, of course, hopefully to help them draw closer to our Lord, and to prepare for the fact that the life we have now is not going to continue. We're moving into what I believe difficult times, a time when there will be a conscious effort to destroy fundamentalists, those with fundamental beliefs, specifically, as you said, the Muslim, the Jew, and the Christian. Now, for the skeptic out there who says, well, that's all well and good, but, you know, how can you say that? Well, very simply, I'm simply quoting something off of a website put up by that great humanitarian, the butcher of Afghanistan, Mikhail Gorbachev, and Marie Strong, the multi-billionaire buddy of Gorby's. And the Earth Charter's website, we have the pages that they took down after they put up, but we got them before they took them down, and they talked exactly those words, eliminate the fundamentalists. Muslims, Christians, and Jews. So if you have any question at all about that, you can give us a call. 1-800-544-8927. We'll send you the pages. We want you to see what they're saying. We have the pages from Barbara Marx Hubbard, who talks about the necessity of eliminating the quarter of the world population that would not evolve to a higher level, and then going on to say, but that is not your job, my dear. That is ours, for we are the riders of the pale horse death. Now, these people are all, whether it's Marie Strong or Mikhail Gorbachev or Barbara Mark Shepard, they're all involved in the occult. And they're all part of this eternal battle between good and evil that is being fought today. The only trouble, right at the present time, it appears that evil is on the throne. But as James Russell Lowell said, though the cause of evil prosper, yet his truth alone is strong, though a portion be the scaffold and upon the throne be wrong. But that scaffold sways the future, for in the dim unknown standeth God within the shadows, keeping watch above his own. And those words, of course, to me are really very, very consoling as I see what's going on today and I realize that we are right at the very front line of that battle. What an awesome responsibility you have and that I feel I have, and I just hope I can be worthy.
Well, and it, Dr. Stan, it's always a remnant at every point. I thought when we started out in this whole thing, if we reasoned and spread enough news about it, we could sort of shift things. We made some marks. But I think in large, there's always a remnant that needs... There's a remnant that thinks that they question themselves whether they're totally wacky or are they so different than the people that they encounter sort of out there in the job place. And two things are to give perspective to what is happening. It gels. A lot of people say, let's look at the church growth movement or some of these consensus programs in business management. And people thought, well, gee, I knew something was wrong, but I couldn't put my finger on it. And then when you begin to talk about it, it goes, ah, okay, now it all makes sense. Now I see where it's going. You know, the funny part about this is people, Americans and the Westerners, are just absolutely inured to this idea of a conspiracy. And there's no other word. I don't know how you get around it, because they view a conspiracy as being a group of people in a back room, you know, wearing whatever. So somebody once said that a conspiracy is a bunch of guys who agree that they're going to clobber you and kill you and hit you over the head with a baseball bat, okay? An agenda is when a group of people write articles on how they're going to hit you over the head with a baseball bat. Then they deny publicly that they actually wrote those articles about hitting you over the head with a baseball bat. And when you finally wake up in the hospital after having been attacked, they said, well, we wrote about it 10 years ago. Didn't you read that? So that's the agenda. And Marilyn Ferguson, one of the insiders, you know, 20 years ago, wrote in the Aquarians Conspiracy. She said, you know, this isn't a dark, dank conspiracy for the most part. This is just an open-minded collaboration of people who have common and interrelated goals, and some people understand a little more about it, and others think it's just about saving the planet or whatever, but they serve ends and goals. And there are a lot of people in the churches who are being duped into doing this. There are a lot of Christians in Germany who are duped into yelling Heil Hitler. I have letters here from pastors written condemning the members of the Confessing Church for their backhandedness and the lover of the dirty, filthy Jew and all of that type of thing. These are written from Christian pastors. While the Confessing Church, and, you know, one of the most courageous things that was ever done in Germany was when Benedict the 15th wrote his papal encyclical, Mit Brennender Sorge, was the only papal encyclical ever written in German rather than in Latin. And it was spirited into Germany and read from all of the Catholic pulpits on a given Sunday, and it attacked Nazism. You never guess who they had bring the courier the letters in, the encyclical, to be read from the pulpits. Well, they didn't trust the Postal Service. They gave it to the Boy Scouts, Dr. Stan, okay, who faithfully carried out the duty. It was such a slap. Now, Malachy Martin maintains that Pope was assassinated, was poisoned, because of his opposition to Mussolini and to Hitler, laying the ground for Pacelli and things to follow. It took a lot of courage to do that. So there were Catholic priests and nuns. There were Protestant pastors in the Confessing Church who stood. The tragedy is that the vast majority of people who call themselves Christians were unable to stand. And remember, that's what Paul tells us we are to do. You know, take the armor of God so that we may be able to stand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. So this concept of resisting, standing, adhering, patience, endurance, I think it's lost on this modern church. This is a soft church that needs a lot of toughening right now, me included, I'll be honest. And we've been talking about this for 15 years.
Well, the important thing is I believe we're to be the watchman on the wall, and we've got a wonderful new video. I don't know if you've seen it yet, Nikito, with David Bay and Carol Matriciana and William Still David Hunt. Greatest thing we've had, at least for those people who are searching for the truth. This new video, Megiddo, gives you the overall view of the move towards world government, our responsibility to be the watchman, and, of course, the coming Holocaust, which is coming in the form of some sort of a nuclear war that will impact on the lives of everybody out there. And this is those times like those, we're going to have to be close to the Lord because we're going to have nothing else to cling to. John, thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure. And thanks. Do you have a website you can go to?
Yeah, people can hear our show at steelonsteel.com. That's just like the metal there. And this is not a time for panic or paranoia. I'm neither panicked nor paranoid. I just know what we're heading to. I've studied it my entire life.
You're only paranoid when you imagine people are against you.
That's true. And even if you're paranoid, doesn't mean you're not being followed.
Good night. God bless. We'll talk to you later. Bye. And that was okay. John Loeffler. I hope you enjoyed the program. Until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, pray for America and pray for Radio Liberty. But please pray for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.